All right, thank you. You may be seated. The first case up today is called Wilson versus the People. May I have the intro of appearances, please? First.
Allison Rutherford, agency appointed counsel for Mr. Wilson.
All right, thank you. Ms. Van Horn.
Patricia Van Horn for the People, registration number 30,002.
All right, thank you. Counsel, this is a one-hour case. Each of you has a half an hour. You'll have to keep track of your own time. You may go ahead, please.
Good morning. Mr. Wilson was convicted of first-degree murder in December 2004 and given the mandatory sentence of life without prison. I was appointed several weeks later after the district attorney abandoned their habitual offender counts, and I've been trying to save Mr. Wilson from himself ever since in the last 10 years because he made several ill-advised decisions during the unusually protracted and lengthy pretrial procedures that lasted over 3 years to fire three sets of lawyers. And he did so out of anger, frustration, paranoia that resulted from his mental illness. I don't think there was an actual diagnosis given by the state mental hospital, whether it was paranoid schizophrenia or whether it was borderline personality disorder or some other personality disorder involving paranoia. But clearly there was mental illness involved. Clearly he could be medicated that could control that mental illness. When he first went into the El Paso County Jail, in 2001, he was not medicated. He fired his first set of lawyers on December 10th, 2001. The very next time he was in court, he was pro se. It was January 14th, 2002, and he was acting so erratically that the trial court then ordered a competency evaluation. But it never dawned on anybody, especially the trial court, and this is one of my frustrations with the courts below and the way they ruled on the 35C, they never made findings of fact on this key factual issue. On December 10th, 2001, when Mr. Wilson was given the first Arguello advisement, was he competent to do so? I mean, just because he answered
all... Was he competent to understand the advisement?
Well, was he competent to knowingly and intelligently waive his right to counsel under either Dusky or the Indiana v. Edwards standard? I mean, no findings were made. And it seems to me that if just 3 weeks later, he's acting so erratically that the district court thinks he has to order a competency evaluation, that it would be incumbent upon the district court, once the state hospital says, no, he's competent, so long as he's medicated, to go back and redo that advisement to ensure that Mr. Wilson was competent at the time that he waived that very fundamental and important Sixth Amendment right, and that never happened. Now, there's always been, you know, this dispute between the prosecution and the defense, whether the state hospital found him incompetent to proceed in this first competency evaluation. I don't think that matters because he was taken down to the state hospital after the January 14, 2002 hearing, and he was put on medication. And the state hospital said he's competent so long as he is on this medication. But again, no findings of fact were ever made whether he was on that medication at the El Paso County Jail. That's one of the findings of fact I was asking the Court of Appeals to order a remand for the district court to make, because the district court skipped over all of these factors and just kept concentrating on the fact that Arguello advisements were made and pursuant to the findings on the Arguello advisement that Mr. Wilson waived his right to counsel. So then, skip ahead a couple of years, what happened, and it's undisputed that the medications were switched by the El Paso County Jail. What's disputed is the effect of that medication switch and whether that caused him to become incompetent, something else caused him to become incompetent, and when reasonably he became incompetent. Because during the next couple of years, he then fired two more sets of appointed counsel. And that happened late enough after he was restored to competency that it can be inferred that because he was no longer being medicated with the medication that the state hospital said he needed in order to be competent, that's what caused these problems. But he fired then a second set of ADC counsel, Susan Martin and Amber St. Clair, and was given another Arguello advisement, and then was allowed to proceed pro se. And then the district court on May 4th, 2004, was the next hearing where concerns regarding his competency were raised when he was pro se, and the district court ordered him sent back to the state hospital for another competency examination. He was found incompetent that time and was put back on the medications, and then there was a hearing on September 24th, 2004. Now, the focus of that hearing was not whether he was incompetent during that entire 3-year period prior to that, but whether what the El Paso County Jail was doing with his medications was proper. They relabeled the medication problem and dispensed it differently than how it was being dispensed at the state hospital. The state hospital wanted 300 milligrams in the morning, 300 milligrams in the afternoon, 600 milligrams at night. What the El Paso County Jail was doing was taking the entire dose, crushing it, giving it to him all at once, which Mr. Wilson was complaining caused him to be sick. So the doctor at the hearing on September 24, 2004 said, no, you know, just re-dispensing the medication in that matter is not causing enough of a problem to raise competency issues. But then that confused the Court of Appeals, I think, because when I was in front of them in oral arguments, they kept asking me, well, could you have raised competency on direct appeal? I mean, why didn't you appeal the fact that he was not competent on September 24, 2004? It's because that wasn't the issue. I think on September 24, 2004, indisputably, he was competent pursuant to at least Dusky. But that's not the point. The point is when he fired Susan Martin and Amber St. Clair all those months previously, was he competent to do so? Was he competent to waive that very important Sixth Amendment right? And then nobody ever made any findings of fact in 2001 or 2004, either the doctors or the court, as to just because he was competent pursuant to Dusky, was he also competent to represent himself?
Ms. Ruttenberg,
a first-degree murder trial with dozens of witnesses.
Can I stop you there? Good morning. Let me start out by asking, because it's a tortured history for a number of years.
Right.
But when was the last time, what was the date of the last time he had counsel?
Let's see, he fired Susan Martin and Amber St. Clair. On December 16th, 2003.
And when was the last time he had a competency evaluation?
He had a competency evaluation after the May 4th, 2004 hearing, sometime between May 4th, 2004 and September 24th, 2004.
And he was found competent at that?
He was found incompetent and then restored to competency so long as he was on the medication.
But I thought it went to trial in May of 2004.
No.
When did he actually go to trial?
December of 2004.
Thank you. You're right.
And he, another ADC lawyer was appointed to him in after that second competency evaluation, after September 24, 2004, but just for the habitual counts and for the other case. He had picked up another case in the El Paso County Jail when he was tased after he tried to give a cheese sandwich to another inmate, and there was subsequent felony charges that was asserted against him. And that lawyer was willing to represent him in the murder trial as well, but the court said, I can't give you an extension of time. And she said, I don't have enough time to prepare prior to December 2004. So she was forced to proceed pro se on his first degree murder case. And he made critical mistakes at trial. the type of mistakes that either pro se defendants or mentally ill people make. He was so paranoid. I mean, a theme of him is that incompetent people keep being appointed to represent me. So he thought that his the lawyer that was appointed to assist him as a pro se lawyer was incompetent, and that was part of this conspiracy against him. So he wouldn't take any advice from this lawyer. And as a result, he didn't understand how to get in his witnesses from the DOC. He waited too long to try to do it. He had two very critical witnesses he was trying to get in from the DOC, Mr. Punk and Mr. White. Mr. White and Mr. Punk had been with the victim on the night she died, and it's unclear, you know, exactly when, but Mr. White told the defense investigator, and this is all in the 35C motion I filed in 2008, Mr. White told the ABC investigator that he was there with the victim and Mr. Punk, that Mr. Punk is the last person to have seen her alive, and then after her body was found at the homeless camp in a different location where the police discovered the body, Mr. Punk had pulled up the victim's pants and then moved the body. Mr. Punk and Mr. Wilson are similar in appearance. They're the same age, height, same race, same hair color. I mean, they don't look like identical twins, but they have a very similar description. But more importantly, Mr. Punk, only 3 weeks later, murdered another woman by strangling her to death.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Is the issue before us whether Edwards creates a different standard from Dusky?
Yes, and I forgive my long-winded factual introduction, but in order to put that into context, and I'll get to that in just a second, I just wanted to explain why this is so critically important in this case and how it prejudiced Mr. Wilson by being forced to go to trial.
Because your time is limited, maybe we could, you know, agree that he did a lousy job defending himself.
Needless to say, he made critical errors that were not insubstantial and clearly prejudiced him. So, you know, the issue becomes under Edwards whether the courts below erred by saying, look, you know, if you're not disputing the fact that he was competent pursuant to Dusky on December 24, 2004, then there's no issue, because all Edwards said was the district court had the discretion to not allow him to go to trial pro se in December 2004. The district court was not required to do anything else. And I have argued since Indiana v. Edwards came out that no, there's no way to reconcile the three Supreme Court cases of Feretta, Godinez, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and Indiana v. Edwards, without inferring that Indiana v. Edwards must somehow impose a higher level of competency. Otherwise, that contradicts Feretta. And I think that the people's supplemental authority that they filed last week supports that position, especially the State versus Barnes case, the 2014 South Carolina Supreme Court case, where the court said, well, we do not find public policy supports a distinction between a defendant who wishes to plead guilty and a defendant who wishes to proceed to trial, which, by the way, is a different factual situation in this case, obviously, because it's not an issue of Mr. Wilson wanting to plead guilty. It's an issue of whether he was going to proceed to trial pro se or with counsel. But then it says, as the Sixth Amendment guarantees every criminal defendant the right to proceed without counsel when he voluntarily and intelligently elects to do so, and then cited Feretta. So if that's the Feretta standard, then there's no way that the Supreme Court could have reached the decision it reached in Indiana v. Edwards without inferring that there must be a higher level of competency that must be imposed or must be found in some manner by the district court. And I cited case law from quite a few different jurisdictions, and I will concede what I'm asking this court to do is currently the minority rule. So far, only a minority of courts have agreed with me, but it is a substantial minority. There's quite a few states and federal jurisdictions that agree that some sort of higher standard must be imposed. But this court doesn't need to actually define the contours of that higher standard, because you know, it can do, for example, what happened in, for example, the Ninth Circuit. And say, look, you don't have to determine exactly what the standard is, but the court has to make all of these various findings as to whether the defendant, given his mental illness, understands what's going on and can competently represent himself given the facts of the case. And of course, that's going to vary from case to case. If it's a simple misdemeanor case, you know, somebody with a mental illness such as Mr. Wilson might be able to successfully defend himself, such as the cheese sandwich case. But in the first degree homicide case, where it's very complex, you've got all these procedural issues on top of forensic issues. I mean, there was DNA, there was ballistics, there was dozens of witnesses. There was all these complicated procedural issues, such as how to get his witnesses there, and then how to properly argue the alternate suspect. He forgot to ask for the jury instruction on voluntary intoxication because he was highly intoxicated that night.
Let me just interject in this, Mark. I apologize. So if we were to adopt sort of this amorphous standard, just using language from Edwards, and we say, okay, trial courts, go forth and implement that standard. How are trial courts really equipped to make that kind of judgment about representational competency under that very loosely defined standard in Edwards? It just seems like it would be quite a task for a trial judge to try and sort that out. And ultimately, does that then mean the trial court sends people to the state hospital for representational competency evaluations under a standard that would then be very hard for the state hospital? And I'm just trying to imagine how this would actually work in the real world, given how loose the standard is.
Well, what the Iowa Court of Appeals said, and I think this is a good starting point, is that in making the determination, the trial court should consider the manner in which the defendant conducted the trial proceedings. And you know, in this case, it's looking backwards, which is what I was asking the El Paso County Court to do. Look at all the mistakes he made and whether he grasped the issues pertinent to those proceedings, along with his ability to communicate coherently with the court and the jury. So, you know, looking backwards, which is the procedural posture of my case, the district court erred by not doing that and by just kind of stubbornly relying on the fact that, no, I gave him the Arguello advisement back in December of 2001, and he passed the Arguello advisement despite the fact that only 3 weeks later he was acting so erratically that the district court sua sponte sent him down to the state mental hospital. And, you know,
Mr. Robert, can I follow up on that? I mean, I got to tell you, we tell the trial judges, go through a trial and see how he does, and then if he doesn't do well, give him a new trial. That's not going to go over well. I mean, how do we do that prospectively?
Well, I think that this court should do what the Florida Supreme Court did and amend the Arguello advisement by rule of the court and say when mental illness is an issue, I mean, mental illness is not going to be an issue in every case, but when mental illness is an issue, especially when the district court sua sponte recognizes that mental illness is an issue, then the district court has to make additional findings that he does not suffer from such a severe mental illness to the point where the defendant is not competent to conduct trial proceedings by his or herself. And only the district court is in a position to be able to determine that based on how the defendant is behaving in the courtroom. And Mr. Wilson gave ample kind of indication that he was unable to grasp not only procedurally, but conduct himself in such a manner as to be able to handle a two-week-long first-degree homicide case, and the district court never made any findings at all regarding that when the district court made findings that Mr. Wilson was competent to proceed prospectively after first having our bailiff advisement and then sua sponte sending him to the state mental hospital and then not going back and making any findings that either at the time he waived his right to counsel that he wasn't suffering from such a severe mental illness to the point that he was not competent to waive his right to counsel or that he was not competent then to conduct trial proceedings in a first-degree murder case based on how he has been behaving in the court for 3 years when he's been pro se.
Can I ask you one other question?
Sure.
We use the word competency. As a trial judge, I've had a number of people wanting to waive counsel, and some did. I don't know any pro se person that is competent to proceed on a first-degree murder trial. I mean, how do we do that? And even a seasoned lawyer, if they were charged with a serious offense, would want to retain counsel. I mean, I just don't know how we delve into sort of the wisdom of the choice and how do we define competency.
Well, that's why I think that competency to proceed to trial pro se is necessarily differs depending on the level of the charges.
Okay, how would we define that though? If we were to write a rule for the trial judges, how would we define that competency?
Well, whether given the facts of the case, given the length of the trial, the complexities, and all of the complexities of, say, experts and everything else that's expected, is this particular defendant not legally competent, because nobody, and not even some lawyers, are legally competent to conduct a first-degree murder trial necessarily, but does he have the mental capacity, given his mental illness, to be able to do this? And it's somebody like Mr. Wilson, who is so angry and paranoid that he thinks there's this giant conspiracy against him involving the court and all of his appointed counsel and anybody except the one defense investigator that was appointed to him is out to get him. He is not competent, given that mental illness and that level of paranoia, to be able to successfully defend himself. It necessarily has to be a case-by-case determination. This court just can't issue some bright line set of questions that you ask in every single case, like the Arguello advisement, when you have a mentally ill defendant who wants to proceed pro se. It has to be some sort of case by case analysis. And I think the Florida Supreme Court recognized that when they promulgated their new rule in light of the
evidence. Ms. Reinhart, Justice Reinhart.
Yeah, thank you.
How's a trial judge? How are trial judges on an ad hoc basis supposed to assess mental capacity? I mean, there may be instances where you see that someone is so volatile in the courtroom and they're behaving in such a paranoid fashion that you're very much tempted to infer severe mental illness. But it's really outside the bailiwick of trial judges. That's why we have the state hospital and we send them south for comp evals in the first place, right? So I just think that we're expecting a lot of trial judges in asking them to sort out mental capacity, as you suggest.
Well, the trial judge always has to get an expert opinion from the state hospital regarding competency issues. I mean, the ultimate decision is up to the trial judge. But the state hospital has to evaluate this defendant, like, based on his paranoid personality disorder or paranoid schizophrenia or whatever it is, can this defendant understand the facts and circumstances and procedures in this case such that he knows what to do and how to defend himself and that his paranoia is not going to get in the way of him being able to make decisions?
So under the regime that you're suggesting, would it be a necessary predicate that there be some diagnosis of severe mental illness or some kind of psychotic illness, for example? It's a diagnosis that's been made by an expert, presumably, typically someone in the state hospital, but it could be someone else, but an expert, psychologist, psychiatrist.
Well, I think in every single case where Indiana versus Edwards competency to proceed pro se is raised, there necessarily has to be some sort of evaluation by an expert, whether it's state appointed at the state hospital or at the defendant's own expense.
And my question is, resulting in a diagnosis of major mental illness, in order for there then to be any Edwards obligation for the trial court, is that what you're suggesting?
If there's no diagnosis of any type of mental illness, then I think that the Edwards case doesn't even apply. Because if you just have a defendant who just wants to be disruptive and irascible, and, you know, like one of those constitutionalists who are not mentally ill, but they have their own, they fly by their own rules.
Any diagnosis of mental illness would suffice? Antisocial personality disorder or something that would not be a psychotic illness necessarily?
Well, something that could causally, that has a causal connection to him being able to successfully defend himself or successfully do a trial without assistance of counsel.
So I guess if
please,
you all are finished, because I have the same concern. I guess the three trial judges are worried about this because we all have seen ourselves doing these kinds of competency hearings and dealing with these kinds of folks. And one of my problems was that lots of times they would be medicated to a point of competency, and then for whatever reason they would stop taking their meds or this or that, and we would see a disintegration in the courtroom, or even prior to court, or over the course of the entire pretrial hearing. And so a competency hearing, of course, or a competency evaluation is a point in time. We have to say at this particular point he's competent to proceed. How would a trial judge deal with that? I mean, it seems like the Supreme Court might almost want the trial judge to become a pharmacologist on top of everything else.
Well, in this case, it's easy because Mr. Wilson was in the jail. And so long as the jail was following the orders of the state hospital, that's not an issue. But when you've got a defendant who's out on bond, it could be a condition of his bond that he take his medication. And if he's not taking his medication, then his bond should be revoked. I mean,
and how would the judge know that?
Well,
and say afterwards the defendant filed a 35C on like what we're facing today and said, well, you know, I wasn't taking my meds and that's why I was not behaving very competently during the course of the trial.
Well, if the defendant voluntarily stops taking his medications, doesn't tell anybody, and his behavior is such that nobody notices that his behavior has become more erratic, then he's created his own problem for himself that he's not going to be able to resolve by a 35C motion. So that kind of begs the question, if he stops taking the medication voluntarily, doesn't tell anybody, but his behavior in the courtroom isn't affected, then there's not an issue. But if his behavior in the courtroom is affected, then, you know,
he's going to have to tell the truth
as to whether he's...
Excuse me, then we get back to Justice Boatwright's question, which is, do you have to take it on a day-by-day basis whether or not this defendant is competent to actually handle the court? I tell you, I had a defendant once in my courtroom who was representing himself extraordinarily well and told him, picked up a pitcher of water and dumped it on my court report. And so we all have, I mean, this is not something idle, I think, in our minds. We all have very real images that we're worrying about. Now, that in that particular case, maybe that's more extreme. But how does a trial judge, and we deal with these kinds of situations constantly, how does a trial judge even begin to make an order upon which a trial can proceed?
Well, that's why I think the Edwards case itself gives the trial judge all of this discretion to not even let the mentally ill defendant, where you've got these concerns to begin with, to be pro se at all to begin with.
But that's not the way they wrote that decision. I mean, that's what you wish the United States Supreme Court had written, but that's not what they wrote.
Well, I think in Edwards, though, it's clear that the Supreme Court said that if the trial judge has legitimate concerns regarding the defendant's competency to proceed to trial pro se and stay properly medicated, behave himself in the courtroom, prepare his defense competently and not be affected by his mental illness, that the court then may force counsel upon that defendant without violating the defendant's rights pursuant to Feretta.
Right, but the issue that we're dealing with is not those clear cases, but rather, for lack of a better word, the gray area cases, where somebody would be competent to waive counsel, and then I think what you're advocating is sort of a second test. Are you more and over and above that competent to represent yourself to actually do the work in the courtroom?
Well,
isn't that what you're trying to say?
Well, I'm arguing that Mr. Wilson wasn't even competent to waive counsel. I mean, that was one of the issues.
Okay, what tests do you want? What do you want our opinion to say? Let's back into this.
I want your opinion to say that before a trial court can allow somebody like Mr. Wilson, who clearly has a mental illness and has clearly behaved in a certain way in the court to raise issues as to whether he's competent to defend himself, and there's an issue as to whether he's being properly medicated, that either the district court has the discretion to compel him to proceed to trial with counsel or has to make specific findings at the critical stages of proceedings, such as on the morning of trial, that he is competent, despite the fact of his mental illness, to proceed with this trial. And if there's any question that he is not, then the district court has a due process obligation to appoint counsel.
Thank you. Ms. Denham?
May it please the court, the question in this case is whether this court should adopt a higher standard of competency for pro se representation pursuant to Edwards. And the people's position, which is actually consistent with the public defender's position in the Davis case, is no. And the problem we see with Edwards is it gives very little guidance as to when a court may properly deny a defendant his constitutional right to represent himself. And if a court were to apply too high a standard, it could cause the trial court to erroneously deny the defendant his right, which would be per se reversible error. We also have concerns about the practical implications about how we adopt this test. Edwards indicates that the only time a state court can properly deny a defendant his right to represent himself is when he suffers from a severe mental illness, and that severe mental illness prevents him from being able to accomplish basic trial tasks. So we think that in order for a trial court to know whether the defendant before them is one of those defendants, it would need to have a professional evaluation by a mental health evaluator. But where would that take place? Who would do it? What criteria would those evaluators use? We would assume that the mental health community would need to kind of work with the legal community in determining what does that mean, basic trial tests and ability to perform basic trial tests, and how would we set up those tests. And we think other would we force someone to undergo this? Would speedy trial toll? Where would we send them? And so those are the concerns that we have about adopting the test.
Those are all great concerns. And the state has a duty, I think, to make sure there's a fair trial, right, ultimately.
Yes,
that's what due process
means.
And there are circumstances where a trial judge can require someone, despite their wish to represent themselves, can require a counsel, right?
Can
you just tell us what those narrow circumstances might be so we might separate the sham people who kept, you know, as in our D'Atley case, arguably, where Mr. D'Atley, perfectly competent, kept his charge in counsel. So our Arguello advisement was given here. So the issue is whether he knowingly, intelligently waived his right to counsel, and whether or not the state has some due process obligation to require, in this case, appointed counsel for someone who has a mental, you would agree he had a mental illness.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
What I looked over his competency reports because Edwards does place an emphasis on severe mental illness. And Mr. Wilson was diagnosed with a personality, paranoid aspects to his thinking, grandiosity, intellectually functioning in the high range of normal, organic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder. He suffered a severe head trauma as a child, and many of these medications he was taking, including the medication that was dropped at the jail for a time, was anti-seizure medication. And I believe from what I read in these reports as well, that those anti-seizure medications also can help stabilize the mood. So I'm not even sure if he was diagnosed with a serious mental illness as defined in Edwards in this case. And I also think in this case, when you look at the defendants, our boy advisements, and that kind of thing, his conversations with the trial judges who did these advisements, very coherent. He knew what was going on. He discussed the state budget. He discussed motions he wanted to file. He cited to law. And you look at his written motions, the same thing. He cited to relevant authorities, etc.
Well, just while you're on the issue of the language severe mental illness in Edwards, it sort of begs the question of, as you suggest, of what constitutes a severe mental illness, right? And so what do you even peg that to? What do you imagine the Edwards Court was contemplating when they referred to severe mental illness?
Well, Edwards himself was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Right.
So I'm assuming they said that's a severe mental illness. But I think that's why we need some input from mental health professionals in this, in developing it. And I think the trial courts could use that guidance. Is this truly a severe mental illness? And I also don't think that as the inquiry, because I think Edwards doesn't say just severe mental illness. It has to be the type of severe mental illness that inhibits him, precludes him from being able to present or conduct basic trial tests.
Thank you.
So how would a trial judge even go about this? You're saying that it's almost impossible to do. Is that your position, to have this sort of second add-on test?
I think it would be very difficult for a trial judge, especially, I mean, depending on when in the proceedings this came up. I think the trial court would really need the benefit of a mental health evaluation where someone was looking at these new criteria. And I think those kind of criteria...
What are these? The Edwards criteria? Well, what are the new criteria? Are the new criteria that somehow the medical community is going to come up with?
Well,
but hasn't yet?
The criteria is inability to perform basic trial tests. And I don't think right now when competency evaluations are being done, of course, they're looking at those kinds of things. And I don't think a mental health professional is necessarily now well suited to know what that is. And that's why I would think that the mental health community would need some kind of input from the legal community about how this would work and what, if we wanted to do this. And that's why we think it should maybe go through the General Assembly, that they could, if we wanted to develop this, and we have great concerns about adopting this test, it would need to go through that avenue, because there's so many questions there about what does that mean, ability to perform basic trial tests and what those are.
So recognizing that maybe that's a task in your mind that is left to the legislature, what happens in the meantime? So if a trial court gives an unwavering advisement and is satisfied that a waiver has been knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily made, and yet has these concerns, what should the trial court do?
Right now, today?
Yeah, today, in the absence of anything, any further guidance from us.
If the trial court doesn't think that there's a mental condition that's negatively impacted the defendant's ability to actually make a waiver, the trial court thinks that the waiver itself is valid, I think right now a trial court has to let the defendant represent himself.
I'm not sure I understand that. Isn't that what we're arguing about with Indiana v. Edwards? Doesn't Edwards seem to say, and I took it that was exactly the point that your opponent is saying would be inconsistent without a separate standard of competence, doesn't it seem to say even if the defendant is able to make an effective waiver of his Miranda rights, nevertheless, the trial judge has some discretion to deny him the right to self-representation?
We're going to leave it up to state courts to determine if we want, yes, that it's the trial court has that discretion.
So where we are,
state courts have the ability to adopt that and allow it, is what Edwards says.
And yet it seems that you seem to be saying that the trial court's in no position to actually make that actual determination, at least at this juncture, without help of professional
evaluators.
I think it would be very difficult for a trial judge to be expected to, first of all, the trial court would have to determine, is this a serious mental illness? Is this one that is defined as a serious mental illness? Then the trial court would have to determine, okay, if someone suffers from this mental illness, how does it affect this person's ability to be able to perform basic trial tests? Now, in some situations, and in Edwards, of course, he was subject to retrial, and so the court had dealt with Edwards for over a period of time, the trial court might be a little better suited to know whether this particular defendant had that ability, but that's not going to be the situation in every case. And that's the concern, is how the trial court is going to make that call on its own to determine, can this defendant perform basic trial tests?
But are you saying that the trial court, in general, is not ever going to be in that position? Do you agree that Edwards says the trial courts have that discretion?
Yes.
When that concern exists. And now I'm just trying to square that with your position that trial courts, as a general rule, are not going to be in a position to make that determination.
I'm looking at it as a practical matter.
Okay.
I think the U.S. Supreme Court said, we think trial courts are better attuned to do this. But as a practical matter, for a trial judge to, and maybe this comes up the week before trial, a few days before trial, to be able to make that judgment call about whether this defendant suffers from this illness and this defendant is going to be able to do this, I think given how vague Edwards is and the consequences of what happens when you violate someone's parental right, I just think you're putting the trial courts in a very difficult position without a lot of guidelines.
And so in the absence of such guidelines, basically, if the Arguello advisement is good and the waiver is valid, go forth.
Yes, Your Honor.
You go.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm mildly confused about the approach because the question seems to be the petition on behalf of the defendant asking the question whether Edwards actually creates a new standard for competence that would have to be applied by the trial judge in every case and not just give him discretion.
No,
to deny
I don't
the
agree
defendant.
It has to be
and,
applied.
And you seem
in
to
every
be
case.
Taking the other position, not just that it doesn't have to be applied, that it doesn't create a new standard, but in fact, Edwards doesn't give the trial court discretion to deny a defendant the right to represent himself pro se, even if he thinks in this gray area or whatever we call it, that the defendant would not be competent to do so.
I think that that's the problem with Edwards, is that it's vague. It creates this permissive standards that allows a state court to adopt a higher standard or allows this to happen. But given this vagueness is why we don't think this court should adopt the standard. I think.
So then it's a sort of a fortiori for you that we should rule against the defendant's question, which is, does Edwards actually create a new standard or not?
Right. I don't think Edwards creates it. It just allows trial courts or state courts to develop this in very specific situations, but gives very vague guidelines as to when it's permissible, it's constitutionally permissible.
Can I ask one follow-up then, and I'll let go on this? Just to pursue what I take to be the defendant's argument here, if Ferretta still stands, and the majority in Indiana versus Edwards, notwithstanding the dissent, seem to say it does.
Yes.
Where is the room between saying the defendant has a right to defend himself as long as he makes a effective waiver of his right to counsel, and saying that a trial court has the discretion, nevertheless, to deny him that right?
Where they're saying the trial court can deny him that right is when he falls into this gray area.
But unless the gray area means that he couldn't make an effective waiver, how can one say that he has the right to go pro se and yet he can be denied the right?
And I see that. I don't understand personally in reading the Edwards decision how somebody could make a perfectly valid, knowing and intelligent waiver and yet lack the competency to perform trial tasks. I mean, when we look at our own Arguello advisement, if somebody actually understands all those things being read to them in the Arguello advisement indicates, I get it. I just don't know where that would end up falling. I just see a lot of problems with the Edward decision because it just leaves so much open.
Chief, did you have something?
Oh, lots, but you go ahead.
Well, I don't know how someone could get through the Arguello advisement and then lack those abilities to be able to represent him or herself at trial. I suppose it hinges on at least a couple of things. One is how rigorous the Arguello advisement actually is. I mean, we know there are 14 points in the appendix to the decision, and if that is really administered in a robust fashion, you might be able to glean something from it. But often it can be done in a more perfunctory way, right? That doesn't necessarily reveal a whole lot about a defendant's cognitive abilities. And as the chief said earlier, sometimes folks come in when they're on meds, when they're given the Arguello advisement, and they're actually hitting on all cylinders at that moment, or more cylinders, right? But it doesn't really provide you any meaningful indication of how they're going to perform at trial. So,
and the part of the problem is, too, is you can't deny a defendant his right to represent himself just because he lacks technical knowledge. And so I don't know exactly how that comes into play with determining whether he has the ability to perform basic trial tasks if you can't consider his legal technical knowledge either. I mean, that's why I think we shouldn't adopt one, and if we are, we just need some input from experts, mental health experts, and maybe the legal community and the criminal defense bar on how this would possibly work. Because I don't see how it would work and how it would practically work. In the middle of trial, for the court to stop and say, and let's say you're on bond, I'm going to make you go to the state hospital and undergo this evaluation and to determine whether you're competent or not to represent yourself. And do we hold someone there until he's restored to competency to represent himself? I just see so many problems coming into play with this whole thing.
And so then, in your mind, the real critical juncture then becomes that Arguello advisement and the waiver. In other words, if the trial court, in your view, concludes that the waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, we've kind of met that threshold. And I guess I'm still questioning whether you simply disagree with the discretion that's allowed under Edwards, or you're simply saying that as a practical matter, it's hard to exercise that discretion.
That's more what I'm saying. As a practical matter, it's very hard to exercise it. Edwards itself speaks of, we give trial courts discretion over this because they are dealing with the defendant and they see the defendant, you know, they can appreciate any limitations that defendant might have. And I think that might be true in certain situations and true up to a certain point, but it's not true in every case.
Well,
I don't want to monopolize the
obviously time. I'm totally perplexed with this, and I'm sympathetic, obviously, that trial courts have to make hard decisions. But it seems to me that, you know, we have a balancing of constitutional rights in many arenas, and what we're looking at is pitting the constitutional right to represent yourself, but also protecting the due process right of somebody who has a severe mental illness to override that and require counsel just because the trial judge has an instinct that there's a due process issue. So I'm sure I'm not helping you here, but, you know, the problem is when you look back, when appellate court looks back at something that's already occurred, and you believe, you know, based on the circumstances of what happened at the trial, there was a due process violation, and that conviction should stand, especially in a life imprisonment without parole situation. Now, I know you will resist, you know, it depends upon what the gravity of the crime is, because we're looking back there, but how do we function with a standard that allows and encourages even the trial judges to override that instinct for whatever it is of a mentally ill person to say, no, I can represent myself and require counsel and do the thing with counsel? I mean, I think that's where we are, and if it's not under the federal constitution, I'm sure that the Supreme Court in this case basically said, states, you're the great incubators of democracy, and you know, you have all this wisdom, figure it out. But you have this discretion under the constitutional standard.
And I always go back to this. I mean, part of this we look at, is it fair? And I always say, fair to whom? Because if I'm a pro se person and I have a defense and I want to present that defense, but the legal minds around me say, oh, no, you should not present that defense. That's my defense. And I just wonder where we draw that line and who makes the call about my capabilities, about the defense I want to present. I'm troubled by that idea because we know Florida still stands and we know people still have a constitutional right to represent themselves. And
but it's not an absolute right, is it? I mean, say that.
No, Your Honor, not at all. But, you know, in situations where, and I had a case in this court maybe 12 years ago where the defendant adamantly wanted to represent himself and his defense was a little bizarre, to say the least. And but who's to make that judgment? And I have concerns about cases like that where somebody, the judge, is saying, well, I think that seems a little crazy under these circumstances that that person wants to represent himself. But that's the defense he wants to present. And maybe it might seem crazy to all of us, but it doesn't seem crazy to that person. And that's the defense he wants to go forward with. And so I do have the problem when we look at the fairness. It's fairness in whose eyes?
Ms. Van Horn, can I switch the topic just a little bit? What if the judge in this case had looked at this and said, Mr. Wilson, I just am not going to let you go pro se? Yeah, under these facts, clearly Mr. Wilson's got paranoia. I mean, granted, is it a personality disorder versus something else? I mean, let's say he looked at it and said, this is a severe mental illness. He just can't represent himself. I'm going to force him to have counsel, and he's convicted. Ms. Ruttenberg is now standing there arguing that it should be reversed because he had a right to go pro se.
I would have a very time arguing he did not.
You would have, you said you would have a hard time arguing?
I would have a hard time arguing that the trial judge
wouldn't you have an easier
prohibited,
time?
Properly prohibited him from representing himself.
Wouldn't you have an easier time now, though, under Indiana versus Edwards? Because the trial judge could say, you might be competent to waive, but you're not competent to go to trial.
I think based on this record, he was not one of these gray area defendants.
But if he were a gray area person, I mean, that's the question that Justice Boatwright just asked you is what I was thinking about, too. Doesn't carry to its logical extreme, doesn't Indiana versus Edwards almost make it easier to deny someone of their right to counsel? Because lots of people are competent to waive counsel, but who is competent to try a case?
I agree. I think it makes it easier.
And if you can't take that second step, then the logical conclusion is, I'm not going to let you waive counsel, isn't it?
I think the problem with this, Indiana v. Edwards is so narrow and lacks any specifics, and it applies to only this narrow class of defendants. On this record, in my defendant, and what if you read through the trial record, you read through the motions he filed, he was able to perform all the basic trial tests. He did.
Well, I guess I see maybe the significance of this series of oral arguments that we're going to be having to decide whether there really is that second step that we need to require our judges to, whenever they go through an Arguello advisement and find that someone is competent to waive counsel, whether they then need to have another kind of assessment to determine whether or not the person is competent to actually try the case. Do you see it that way or not?
We just don't think enough guidelines are in place to do that.
I don't think that's a good idea. All I'm asking is whether, do you see that that's quite simply boiled down the issue that we're facing, whether to do that or not?
I mean, the issue is, as I view it in this case, is you were just considering whether to adopt it. Mm-hmm. And our position is, of course, no.
Right.
For now.
I, I guess this is the part. See, you're still arguing that we shouldn't allow a trial judge the discretion to deny the defendant his right to represent himself if he makes an effective waiver. But isn't that's not the question before us, is it? Isn't the only question before us whether he has to? In this case, he didn't allow, he didn't deprive the defendant right. of his right.
And I'm, so the I'm argument focusing is focusing on the cert question itself is whether Colorado, this court should adopt a higher standard of competency, which was the general cert question.
You're going up. In other words, whether we should add a second step as opposed to what I see is down, whether we should allow them to, right? And I agree, but if you look at it in, globally, the question that Justice Coates is asking you is kind of necessarily involved, isn't it? And what would your response be to that?
To whether we should adopt, have a like a third part to the Arguello test?
Let's start there, sure.
We could, but I think we just need more information about what that would entail. And that's the problem I have with it. When a court could properly find that and when a court could not properly find that.
So the logic tree would be something like this. If you, the first question that a trial judge would have to ask is, can the defendant, is the defendant competent to waive, yes or no? If yes, then can the defendant be allowed to try the case, yes or no? And if no, then he can't waive. It's almost circular, isn't it? Is that correct?
Is he competent to waive?
Yes or no? And if the answer is yes, he can waive, then we have to ask, well, he might be competent to waive, but is he competent to try the case? And if your answer there is no, then don't you necessarily have to say that he can't waive?
I don't know how the judge could get to the no question. That's the problem.
Just say with the logic of it, then don't you necessarily have to say that, well, you might be competent to waive because, but since you're not competent to try the case, you can't waive. I mean, isn't that what Indiana versus Edwards is kind of telling us, or trying to tell us?
I think Indiana v. Edwards says it's okay, but it's not saying that that's what the result has to be.
So, may I follow up? So, I guess the question, if I'm understanding it correctly, the Chief is posing is whether you could fold the concern into the Arguello analysis, or whether it's sort of inherent in the Arguello inquiry as to whether there's been a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver of the right to counsel.
I think it's, in a sense, it's part of the Arguello advisement, because if a defendant, he's competent, and there's no question about the Dusby competence, and you get the advisement, the current standard advisement, and the defendant does not understand that advisement and indicates he is not getting what that advisement. I think that's a safeguard we have here that would prevent a defendant from representing himself, even though he got the advisement and was competent to waive, it wasn't a knowing and intelligent waiver. And so we almost get to the same place where we're not going to allow you to represent yourself because you're not getting the advice, you're not understanding the advisement. I just don't understand how a court in this situation, it would be easy for a court to determine consistent with Edwards so we don't violate Feretta. The narrow situation that Edwards allows a trial court to deny the defendant his right to represent himself.
Even though he's competent to waive that right. That's what I'm suggesting is the irony, actually, of this opinion.
Could I ask one question about competence versus knowing an intelligent waiver of a trial right? But do you seem to be equating the two is such that you feel that someone, even without regard to the new standard, but let's say just under Dusky, under our standard, that a person could not make an effective waiver of a trial right if he's incompetent?
Under Dusky?
Yeah.
Under Dusky, I don't think a person could make a valid waiver. If they don't meet the DESI standard, they need to...
Right. If, let's say somebody's incompetent to go to trial. Do you think that necessarily means he couldn't make an effective waiver of a trial right?
Yes.
Okay. So in effect, those are, you're equating the waiver of a trial right, if not equating them, at least a DESI standard is so low that one could never understand his rights and waive those.
Right. Okay. And I was trying to think of situations perhaps where somebody, they were clearly competent, and situations where, but they could not make a valid waiver. Somebody maybe with very low intelligence, very little understanding when they're competent, but they just cannot validly, knowingly, and intelligently waive their rights. So I think we might run into that. And I don't have much time, I'm sorry. If you have any questions about this specific case, about the facts in this case.
So it sounds like there was an Arguello advisement in 2001, and then the defendant was found to be incompetent, restored to competency. Was there a subsequent Arguello advisement?
Yes, there were, in 2003, trial judge started the Arguello advisement on the 16th of December. Conflicts judge did an Arguello advisement on the 18th of December. Trial judge resumes Arguello advisement on the 18th of December. Thorough Arguello advisement, if you read those. I see I'm out of time, but he's talked rationally and had lots of conversations with the courts.
Thank you.
I'd ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ms. Rittenberg. Thank you. And Ms. Van Horn, thank you very much. We're going to take a 15-minute recess.